All right, I'm Jay Johnson, and I'm joined by John O'Malley. John, thanks so much for joining me on this podcast.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, John, if you guys don't know him, is the boys' coach at Sandburg High School. I'm going to brag about John on his behalf right now. He's had 9 kids run under 154 and 26 different athletes run under 158. He's had some fantastic 4x8s in the state of Illinois. They have the Illinois state record at 7:37. But then on the other end of the continuum in cross country, he's the only coach to have coached 2 Foot Locker champions in Lucas Verzbikis and in Dylan Jacobs last year. So, John, I don't know if you're turning pink by embarrassment or what now, but yeah, man, I really enjoy or really appreciate you joining me, and we'll probably talk a little bit about cross country and talk about the 800.
Sounds great. Yeah, it's been beyond anything I've expected for sure. So when you start rattling off some of that stuff, I mean, when I first started coaching in 2003 and having goals of like someday having an all-state runner and things like that, and just to think, you know, never even envisioning being in Balboa Park in San Diego, let alone having 2 national champions. It's been a wild journey. It's not what I like set out to do, and it's been, you know, just building on itself. So it's really neat and really lucky too.
Yeah. Well, I as somebody who's been involved in the sport for a long time, you have to have genetic talent to have 2 Foot Locker to have 2 kids to win that race.
For sure.
But at the end of the day, to have 26 boys run 158, or to have 9 kids run under 154, that shows that you have a system in place to help kids run 2 laps fast. And so at some point in this conversation, we're talking on November 14th of 2018, and what if you don't mind, can you talk about this year's cross country season, and then we'll lead that into what you're going to be doing for track this year. But yeah, tell us about the cross country season. I believe your state meet was roughly 2 weekends ago.
Yeah, it was about, I don't know, 10 days ago, whatever it was. So yeah, it was in a lot of ways a really disappointing cross country season. So you know, the last 5 years we've had a lot of success, you know, with Nike national teams and Foot Locker national champion and that kind of stuff. And I think what's interesting is, so we had a crew that basically was the what happens after that, right? Like, none of those kids were part of our state title. You know, Dylan Jacobs graduated last year, so suddenly we have this awesome leader and a clear number one runner. Like, there's no argument where number one runner is for the last 2 years. And now we have a group that's inheriting a program that has really high standards and expectations that are just now implicit. They don't even need to be, you know, explained. It's just part of the oxygen. And so it was an interesting year. I really like that challenge, you know, that I identify with that, you know, just personally. So I really like that challenge, and I kind of took that on personally. And so we had a good chunk of the season where things were going really well. And I don't think, you know, we were terrible at the end of the season. We were ranked 13th in state going into state. We qualified for state, which is a very difficult thing to do in the big class in Illinois. You know, that's not something I take for granted at all. And then we finished 16th in state. So, but by and large, just evaluation of our own program, the state meet was an underperformance. We weren't just beat. It was an underperformance. So, me as a coach, I kind of take a step back and say, okay, what did I do wrong there? What can I do to fix that? And evaluating that, I think, is such a huge challenge, because you could be fixing the wrong thing. You could be fixing something that was actually a positive, and you know, so the first step is kind of having an honest conversation with yourself and your team, you know, after the dust has settled and your coaching staff, and figuring out, all right, it wasn't a disaster, but we could have been better. Why could we have been better? And so that's kind of what the last 10 days have been about. But yeah, so I think it's really going to make me a better coach. Again, it wasn't a terrible season. It's not like, you know, I don't want kids to hear this and hear disappointment. You know, we could have done better, and we have honest conversations about that. So that's kind of where we're at. We're at the state level again, short of the national level, which is where we've been, you know, the last 5 or 6 years. So we got a lot of good returning kids. So we're going to work on that over the next year. And I think that's going to be fun and gives us something tangible. And I think, there's definitely potential for just expecting, you know, national performances to happen when they've been, a part of our regular, you know, performances the last 5 years. So, you know, you can't just expect that. You gotta go make it happen. So that's kind of where we're at now, transitioning into track.
What from a training standpoint, what do these, you know, the very first day after the state meet, do they go jog for 20 minutes or do they take the day off? Are you somebody who believes in some time off in between, you know, the end of cross country and the beginning of them resuming training for track?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's sort of individual, but it's I think there's very valid reasoning for giving them just, you know, the traditional 2 weeks of no running and decompress. And there's also valid reasoning in suggesting that, well, you're going to basically increase the risk of injury by doing that when you try to start them back up again, and you're missing out on an opportunity there. And so they're just going to get into bad habits, and they're probably going to start up, you know, a few pounds heavier and all those other things. So I totally see validity in both of those philosophies. I mean, by and large, I defer to the psychological element over the physical element. You know, if there's a tipping point and it's a 50-50 kind of call, I would go to what's more important psychologically. So I talk to them about, you know, the fact that there is potential for the things I just described if you just take 2 weeks off. But I need 2 weeks away from practice, structured practice, and they do too. So we talk about doing things like just going and having fun, like playing ultimate frisbee. If you feel like going for a 30-minute run, go do it. They're really aware of, you know, the different things we do as far as just strength and mobility and getting your body primed to run. So they kind of are really good at going back to those things. If they are going to go for a run, they're not just going to go out the door. They're going to get themselves ready to go for a jog. So it's really unstructured 2 weeks where they've got a lot of options. And I tell them, you know, try to be physical and try to have fun. Don't just sit on the couch for 2 weeks and don't just, you know, eat fast food for 2 weeks. You know, you're not restricted from running. If you absolutely, you know, you need to go for a run to decompress, and go do it. You know, there's some few guidelines with that. I don't want them to go run an hour and a half, you know, but, right. Beyond that, it's mostly their personal preferences, and that's going to interact with how their days are going and how they feel about their season and where they're at emotionally right now.
Yeah. Great. So, you've obviously had a ton of success in track. Is there anything that you'll use from this cross country experience that, and granted, just like you said, I would assume you need 2 weeks from a mental standpoint to kind of regroup as well. But while I don't know you extremely well, I know you well enough to know that your mind just didn't stop thinking track, you know, since state. Well, are there some obvious things? I mean, obviously running 5,000 meters is a lot different than running two laps for your 800 kids, but how, you know, how do you I identify, I think I'm going to change this variable or that variable?
Sure. So first of all, it depends on the kid, but you know, if you're talking about a traditional cross country runner, the variable I think that changes, it depends on your weather situation. So there's that, but So I think that there's, first of all, there's more time between now and our track state meet than there is between our track state meet and our cross country state meet. So you're talking about, like 4 more weeks. So, you know, in terms of preparation, then you can adjust things a little bit. Like you could be a little bit even more patient than normal, maybe, as far as just ramping up, you know, the different dials of, intensity, volume, all that. So we've got a little bit more patience with getting volume up. And part of that is this time of year, you know, we get out of school at 3 o'clock. They're not getting out the door until, you know, 3:30 before, you know, by the time they change and do all of our pre-run stuff. And it is dark at 4:30 here. So there's some limitations there. So, you know, we don't have an indoor facility on top of it. So, but we never go, a week without some element of speed. So that's still emphasized, but I think that, so even though we're being patient, there's still that there, you know, I'm not saying we're just jogging 30 minutes for 2 months. Right. So, but in terms of the difference between cross country and track, I think you're just, definitely kind of dialing down the speed spectrum, right? So, and coupling that with the weather conditions, I think that makes just sense. So, and I think if you could do that in a lot of different ways. So if you're limited by time because of conditions and all that, you know, a 45 minute run could be more of a, like a fartlek type of an effort. You could still get in sets of max sprints. You could still do all those things in 45 minutes to an hour. Can you do a 12-mile run? Probably not, right? So so that variable just kind of naturally is a little bit more slow to develop. And it also goes back to the type of athlete, right? I mean, so some athletes we have are going to be exclusive 800-meter runners or exclusive 400, 800-meter runners or even exclusive miler 800 meter runners. So those athletes will not get to a 90 minute run by and large, whereas our 2 milers will. So that's kind of the first thing we're looking at. I don't know if I answered your question there or not. But.
Yeah. One thing I think is important. I don't know if I explained that you're in Chicago. What does and you're somebody who believes in running fast, and I do want to hear about, you know, what that first week of practice looks like in terms of some of the neuromuscular stuff you're doing, but how often are the roads too icy, or is there snow on the ground? You know, let's say from now, let's say till March 1st, where you have something that you'd like to do from a neuromuscular standpoint that you just can't do.
It happens, but we just adjust. So I mean, it's. You know, so I talk about max speed, and I think occasionally we can't quite reach it in these months, you know, and I don't think it's just by pure relationship to the conditions you're describing. But, you know, if you're doing speed element and say 20 degree weather and it's, you know, blizzard like conditions or it's just icy streets, we still get out there and run and we could still move fast. We just adjust. It may be me shoveling 100 meters of a track. It may be us turning something that we would have liked to have done on the track, but it just snowed that day into, like I said, like a version of a fartlek. So, you know, in terms of max speed, that would not go to traditional max speed, right? You need ample recovery and you need to be in your spikes and all that. But it's probably the best we could do in those conditions and without an indoor facility. So we also, you know, use a hill a lot. So, you know, that's another small area that you can easily clear out and make safe, whether it's a sidewalk or a street or wherever, a path. And, you know, if you're going max for 8 to 10 seconds on a pretty steep hill, you're going to do some good work there. So it kind of, you know, we just adjust. We constantly adjust and it's not always ideal. it's got to be there, and it's got to be present in some way.
Yeah. Well, then that's the perfect lead in to, you know, one of the things that you said in the Boulder running clinics, and you said in High School Running Coach, and I've quoted you all over the place, whether it's on Twitter or on High School Running Coach and whatnot, is our feet are moving fast every day. So would you be willing to share some of the ways, you know, from kind of like Monday through Friday of that first week of practice, what that phrase, our feet are moving fast every day, what that looks like in terms of a certain part of the training day?
Well, great question, because that's something I didn't really address in that, which is there's another way that we definitely can make the adjustment, is that, you know, while we do some things, you know, in a hallway or in the weight room that can relate to this as well. So there's a variety of ways that our feet, quote unquote, move fast every day. Early on, it could be strides, you know, just that's there in the first week. So that's one way. And so strides we would use, you know, in a traditional way for the most part, which would, you know, at the end of a run, you know, something around mile to 5K pace, you know, traditional strides like that. We've also done it where, you know, that's the session. So you come in the morning, you warm up for 12 minutes. We got 12 sets of strides, 150 meter strides, run 5 minutes, and we're done. That's it. That's rather than just the traditional 30 minute morning run. That I would typically do is part of a, I would say, like a rewiring or regeneration, I would call it, which is, let's say the day before we went longer, or it was just a harder day. They're coming in, maybe they were in the snow and, they got jacked around a lot. There's a lot of torquing going on. So you're going to be more likely to have, you know, IT issues and all that because of those kind of conditions. Well, we're going to get things rewired correctly rather than just doing more slogging, more work that's, you know, basically debilitating them. We'll do something along those lines where it's like, we're really going to focus on our mechanics. We're going to do it on a safe, you know, stretch. And, that's going to be the whole session. So that's another way, you know, all sorts of plyometrics, we certainly integrate into it. We start those things fresh. So that's another advantage with the longer track season, is that you can afford to take a day to really teach plyometrics, and technique with those while they're fresh, and devote the entire day to that. So that may be.
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second. Is it?
Yeah,
is there?
Go ahead.
I mean, you guys have had so much success at this point, but was there ever a problem with buy-in with this type A distance kid who loved doing his long runs in August and September and had success in cross country? And you say, hey, we're going to talk about the number of foot strikes today, and I want you to do it in this manner.
It's going to sound arrogant. I can't think.
No, what I absolutely love about this is that, you know, for the longest time I've been working with adults online. So if I ask them to do the lunge matrix, they think it's crazy. Right? Because
yeah,
it's this non-running thing. And I probably answered that question for you as I'm laying it out, which is, I mean, you're in a program where people run under 2 minutes all the time. And if that's what their goal is, I think they probably just fall in line, right? And say, this is how we go about things here.
Right. I have a line, Jay, that, you know, I think is applicable. And I think one, you know, I am a coach full of doubt. Even though we've had, you know, some decent success, but I'm always A, willing to be wrong, and I'm always B, getting my head right before practice. I think, you know, you have to be able to sell what you're doing in a really effective way as a coach when you're coming in, and be certain of it, even though, you know, it may be experimentation. And sometimes you're honest with them about it, and you just say, hey, we're going to try this out, because that's what we're all about. We're all about experimenting, you know. But I do have a phrase kind of related to that, is that it actually comes from a book, Atomic Habits, by James Clear. It came out this year. This guy says at one point in the book, he says, everybody has the same goals. What people need is not more goals. They need more systems. And so, you know, everybody wants to run two flat, right, or under. Everybody wants to win state or go to Nike Nationals and stuff. So let's not even get that. Let's build better systems. And so that's what I'm going there to sell. And I think, you know, related to your question, I think that is a huge emphasis of what my goal is as a coach, is not to come off and say I have all the answers, but to say that we are in this process together. We're focused on this process. We're building systems. Some of them we're going to rewrite, but we're going to get it right, and we're going to continue to work on it and make it better. And we're both devoted to those things. And, you know, I think the fact that I've done that over 15 years, and they've, you know, I can share experiences of failure where, hey, we got this wrong, hey, we got this right, and this is why we're doing it, you know, kind of sells them on it.
Yeah.
So.
And folks, one thing to be very, very, very clear about what's going on here in this interview is I just took the book within the last hour, the book Atomic Habits, out of the backseat of my car in between two car seats into my house. But I bet mine's different than yours because mine has a bookmark in the middle of it. I haven't finished it. And my guess is you have completed that book.
Yeah.
And you've got kids that are 3 years old and two right now, right?
Yeah, you got it.
So, I honestly, I mean, I just think one of the reasons I enjoy, you know, you taking time out of your life to do this is I know you're working so hard for these kids to figure out all the things that you can be doing to improve. I mean, when we were at the Boulder Running Clinics last year, and you started, you know, rattling off all the books that have been important in your coaching. I mean, I'm pretty sure you got interrupted a couple times where people wanted the names of those books. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. You rattled off probably six or seven books that you thought people should consider.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, think, you know, related kind of coming back to our state meet. And I think, you know, being authentic with that stuff, when you're at, you know, it's definitely harder, I think, with you doing like what you're describing, like an online thing or an over the phone coaching thing where they may not see all that you put into your expertise, as well as like kids that spend every single practice with me. And they're also obviously more impressionable 14 and 15 year olds as well. But, you know, the thing I told them after the state meet 10 days ago, you know, here I am, I'm in my 16th state meet and, you know, we've won state and all this stuff. And I apologized to them. I said, guys, you know, I got this wrong. You know, you deserve better. So I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen again. You know, you did everything I asked you to do. And so I apologize. So there's like that. That does two things, I think. I think one, like I genuinely feel that way. Like, you know, if a kid gets injured, that's my fault. You know, that's a kid that I'm in charge of. They wouldn't have gotten injured if they didn't do what I told them to do. Or maybe I didn't pay enough attention to them. If a kid, you know, really has an ability to achieve a goal and that's a genuine achievable goal and I'm on the journey with them and we fall short, I got to own that too. And I think it provokes them to own their actions too. I don't think most people react to that and say, yep, coach, that was your fault. Most of them say, no, that's on us. And when you have a culture of that, where we take ownership over what happens and we're arguing over whose fault it is,
right.
You know,
right.
Like that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I think then when we go to practice and we're like, hey, this is what we're doing. I've read this. There's some really good research backing this up. I think this is going to make us better. Yeah. You know, there's no questions.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So here's something that I love that you shared at the clinic last year. You said you guys don't do a cool down jog. Can you explain, I mean, first, make sure that I heard that right, and then explain what you do instead of that. And I'd also like to know, you know, going back to 2003, I'm assuming you probably did do a cool-down jog.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, for the longest time, it was we've had a low-volume day, so we got to go get some volume before we go home because a race is a low-volume day by and large, unless you're, you know, doing a marathon or something. So, for us, obviously it is. So, Yeah, I used to do the long cool down. Like, hey, let's go do, you know, 30, 40 minutes now, because yesterday was pretty light for a pre-race and today was light, you know. And one thing that I think I started kind of looking at was this idea that how much you move is not as important as how well you move. And that kind of concept is some, I don't know when and where that started ringing in my head. I think probably connecting to some sprint coaches
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. I mean, the moment you said that, I'm thinking, well, that's exactly how a sprint coach would view practice. I mean, they're maybe going to measure volume in meters, but they're going to measure the number of times you went at what velocity or what percentage of max.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's probably it, you know? And, you know, I felt like woefully short of a coach when I started investigating sprint coaches. I'm like, I don't know this about technique, and I don't evaluate, you know, economy. I just assume it improves through this and that, but I don't do anything that they're doing. And I felt like that's not okay, you know, and certainly some things do not translate, but I think that concept certainly does, you know. And we have a really unique job as distance coaches, in that you do have to attend to volume. You know, I'm not a guy that doesn't think volume's important. Mitochondria is a reality, right? But I do think that by and large, the traditional distance coach is more concerned about energy, system, volume than they are about movement patterns. And of course, they're all intertwined. You know, you can't separate them. And so once I started thinking that way, I just started evaluating everything we did. And one thing that kind of provoked this is, you know, I came into the state with Joe Newton at York, who had at the time 250 runners, and
he had 250 boys. I mean, cause it was only a boys program.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. Yeah.
Holy cow.
And they were running massive amounts of volume. And so part of that was a total blessing to me, because I'm never going to have 250 boys on my team. And even if I did, I'm probably not going to get them to do the crazy volume they were doing. So I just asked myself, what are we going to do better than that? And so that's part of the motivation too. I think that was a really fortunate thing, because I went in a direction I wouldn't have otherwise. So anyway, related to this, is a cool down is part of my evaluation of, you know, how are we moving rather than how much are we moving? It's got to be a consideration, is the cool down. And there's value in the cool down from a social standpoint and all that. I totally get that. And so we're going to build that in as well. But what I noticed, especially with a high school cool down, is that it was a lot of crappy running, like a lot of bad mechanics. They're super fatigued now. Right. They're not attentive, because they were just really attentive and focused. And so it's understandable for them not to be worried about their mechanics while they're running after a race. And, you know, they're a little squirrely and fired up and adrenaline pumping and all that. So the attentions are just really piss poor. So what I started doing was giving something to focus on. So we would do something like a fartlek. Right. So do some things like, hey, start running, but you're going to do 20 second surges, you know, every 40 seconds. So you'd get a 20 second surge in every minute, and we would do, you know, 10 minutes of that. Okay. And so that was kind of the start of it. And it depends on the kid too, you know, back to the 400, 800 kid as well. I had an 800 meter runner on our last two 4x8s who hated running. He's a pure sprinter, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he truly says it. He's on. It's like, I hate running. So I literally cut his warm up in half, because he hated running that much. Like, he didn't want to even run for 12 minutes, you know. So there he is. He's warming up with last spring with Dylan Jacobs, the cross country national champion, and Dylan's doing his warm up. And this kid basically ran for 5 minutes, and we did a series of sprints, and he was ready to fire, and he, you know, he ran 156. But so that's part of it. But to your point, I think I'm just really attentive to not letting quote unquote fitness get in the way of being fast.
Yeah.
And I think when you fire poorly over a long period of time, you know, or consistently, that that's patterning bad movement. So on top of it, the thing that I did not fully anticipate, but was kind of integrated into this is I was frustrated with injuries, like a lot of distance coaches. And I'm like, I gotta eliminate this stuff. And kind of looking into how I could limit injuries or eliminate them. That's my goal, is to have no injuries. Right. And it's truly my goal is looking at how movement relates to injury. Right. So, and we've had so few injuries. It's been amazing since we started doing this, you know. I think one of the reasons why is because we don't do a lot of bad mechanics while we're just fatigued.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. This is not in the questions I wanted to ask, but I can't help myself now. Do you mind quickly walking through Dylan Jacobs' progression, just rough numbers, his volume, freshman through senior year? And then maybe can you say, you know, like his five or six biggest volume weeks his senior year? And it's funny, as I'm asking this, now I know I'm talking to this coach who measures stress, not volume. So you might not be able to answer this. But the only reason I would love some insight on it is I think some people think, I mean, I'm pretty sure Chris Selinski was running big volume back in, you know, 2002, and when he won the Foot Locker National Championship. And
sure.
And I just think it'd be interesting for people to hear, you know, how much a young man ran to win that race.
Right. And I mean, Lucas Rosbikas would relate to this too, because he was not a big volume guy. That's the interesting thing is, you know, these two Foot Locker National Champions, neither of them running large volume. So I can give you, because I get asked the question so much about weekly mileage, and I, you know, we've talked about it before, that that's a frustration of mine. I don't even count them we can get into that, but I won't right now. But since it's asked so often, and I do get that that's one metric, it's volume, right? But I can kind of give you a pretty rough estimate. I can give you very specific stuff on some things, but this is a rough estimate on how he went. So Dylan came in as a freshman. He was probably in the 90-pound range, 90 to 100-pound range, and was clearly a good runner. He wasn't stellar, like he was good. He didn't break 16 for 3 miles or anything like that. But you could tell he was a decent runner. But he had an athletic background. He played soccer and baseball and basketball, and so he'd always been very active. So he had an athletic background, but had really terrible, I mean, god awful mechanics. As far as you could look on the bottom of his shoes, and his 4 feet had holes in them, even though they were like 3 weeks old.
Interesting.
Because of the way he was landing. And I couldn't even decipher everything that was wrong with it, but just looking at some things, you know, like we talked about the single leg squat test and how his knee would just crash in, just spiral right in. So anyway, that matters, because we did not just ramp the hell out of his volume, even though we saw that this kid was going to be good. So as a freshman, he was probably running between 30 and 40 miles a week, you know, after he got just used to consistent running. So this is not where, you know, wasn't like his first week or his second week, but he probably got up to about 40 miles a week as a peak. Sophomore year, he made a huge jump and was running varsity for us. And he was running probably about 50 miles a week at that point. And by a huge jump, I mean, in performance.
Right. So
he's running about 50 miles a week. And that progressed his senior year. I would say the highest volume he ever reached was maybe 70. But it was probably closer to 65. So somewhere in that range.
Right. Right. Yeah. And thanks for doing that. I know that's not your favorite thing to give the volume, but I just think it's important for people. You know, I'm friends with Brad Hudson. He's a guy who ran, you know, 130, 140 miles a week when he was in eighth grade, right? And you know, I was running in high school in the 90s, and you know, 50 miles a week was a lot then. So to me, there's this happy medium, and I was hoping you would say around 70 miles a week. And then if you monitor strep, what Dylan Jacobs is doing to get that volume, and talking about all these things he's doing before the run and after the run, that's right. If you were to measure his stress, now we are in the realm of maybe a kid running 80 or 85, and yet what's great is that he's got this window. I mean, what I love about learning more about your training is you're definitely setting kids up to run well in college, because structurally they're so strong. Now the college coach can add even more intensity and more volume.
Yeah, that's the goal for sure. I mean, I don't think all we're doing is preparing kids for college, but I definitely want them to have that option. And, you know, there's the argument between saying, well, they got to get to a certain volume to be able to continue to do, well, essentially 10K training, right, which is high volume in college, of course. And then there's the other argument that's saying you're doing too much volume and you're burning them out before college. So I've heard it all. But so I think my goal is exactly what you described. I think, you know, he didn't, you know, when we say about 70 miles a week, it was not just a one-time occurrence, right? He was very comfortable with that volume. But you're absolutely right that all this other stuff that we're doing, I wouldn't put in a mileage count, but certainly adds a stress to his training load. And yeah, the goal was, like, this is a kid with terrible mechanics who, you know, got injured, as a sophomore, who now is pretty robust and pretty efficient and can run a 49-second quarter, even though he's like 130 pounds and doesn't look like a 49-second quarter guy. And can, and he can win Foot Locker too. It's not like he's just a sprinter. So I think that's something a coach can work with, you know?
Yeah.
So like he's got plenty of room to grow in volume, and he's got some improved mechanics, and he should be all set to go.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so I have two separate questions, but I'm going to see if I can combine them into one. Let's just, under the heading of how does John O'Malley improve as a coach, and you can talk about books. You can talk about other ways to get info on the internet, or you can talk about going to clinics. You know, how are you trying to improve? Or and I guess there's a fourth one you talked about at the Boulder Running Clinic, seeking out, you know, people who understand speed and developing speed in the Chicago area, and you know, just going and talking to them face to face. But yeah, how and I guess the one thing I would highlight is also specifically when you go to a clinic, how do you leave not overwhelmed with wanting to change 20 things in your program?
Yeah, so the first thing I'm really attentive to is that I study, as we've talked about a lot, but the bigger thing that I need to keep reminding myself of, of course, is that none of that matters if I'm not developing the relationship with the kids. So as far as like what I'm thinking about right now is how I can improve most as a coach is I've got to get even better relationships with my athletes, you know? And so that's something I want. That's my number one goal this off season, is that I'm going to be even better at that. So that's one thing, but related to, you know, just gathering information, gathering knowledge and learning different ways to think. I think, I always looked at clinics, like a lot of presenters will say, I'm here. If you take away one thing, then I was a success today. And a while back, I kind of considered like, no, that's not what I want. Like, you know, because I was going home with one drill and one workout and one this, and it doesn't work, right? Like it needs to be synthesized into your system. And you need to ask if it makes sense, right? So it's all a relationship. So my goal about 5 or 6 years ago was to challenge the way I think. That's how I started framing it. So I'm going to read different types of books. I'm going to go talk to the sprint coach. I'm going to go talk to basketball coaches. I'm going to, you know, I felt like I'd accumulated 10 years of these, you know, standard distance background knowledge, and there's still always more to learn. But I felt comfortable enough that it was time that I could start challenging the way I thought more than just trying to pick up a drill. So I think, I just got an email from someone, saying thank you for sharing information, and they had a successful season. They took second in state, and he said, the biggest takeaway was that I just started going to practice at the beginning of every week and asking, what do my girls need this week? Which is something I got from you. And he's like, I didn't just take all your workouts and now we're doing O'Malley's workouts. And likewise, that's what my goal is. When I went and listened to the guys at the Boulder and Joan Hunter at the Boulder Running Clinic last January, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to take Doug Soule's workouts and now we're going to do all those. I'm going to examine how Doug Soule's approaching practice and training that can challenge the way I think and evaluate practice and training. So that's, I think, it's vague, I guess, but I think that's a better framework to work from is like, you're not just inserting X and inserting Y on certain calendar dates. You need to be a better observer. You need to be a better evaluator. You need to be a better problem solver. Like, those are the goals. And so when you go and access knowledge and information and experience from speakers, that should be the goal. It's like, this is going to improve my evaluation, my ability to evaluate. So anyway, I know that's maybe too broad, but
no,
so
I mean, what's fantastic about that is it highlights that, I hope people come to the Boulder Running Clinics. We're going to have great speakers. It's going to be great. Da 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 da. But there is kind of this sweet spot in having for the type. I think it attracts the type of coach who's been coaching for 10 years, isn't looking for some wholesale change, but is kind of taking this step back and just kind of saying, what does an overview of Loudoun Valley look like, or Great Oaks, or your program, and almost just get like a sense of the spirit of how somebody is approaching their training.
Right.
John Sipple trains kids very differently than you do, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. He's one of your closest friends.
Yeah, we're each other's best men.
Yeah. So, and interviewing you guys for high school running coach, I mean, obviously you guys have bounced ideas off each other for years and years now, but the way you approach it is completely different. His boys were what, fourth at NXN last year?
Right.
And he's having a ton of success. So yeah, I think that's a great way to answer it. I am curious if there's anything online that you'd recommend people check out.
I generally don't, and that's just a personal, I am a book reader. I do follow, like, I am on Twitter, and I do not follow like friends on Twitter as much as I follow, sources of knowledge. So those are the two ways I most access information. And then, like you just described, conversations and clinics and those kinds of things. So I'm not like a website searcher or anything like that. Just because I think there is a point where you have information overload and you're not even able to absorb what you're getting. But so I think, something like the Boulder Clinic, I think, is just there. You cannot place enough value on that. And those experiences where you're having conversations, and while someone is up there talking, it's not like you're writing down everything they're saying. You are thinking, and it just forces you to think and like connect in ways that you wouldn't otherwise. And then, I've gone back and watched those videos. I can't tell you how many times.
Yeah, because I think that for somebody who's dying to improve, the fact that you don't have to take all the notes, and it's not just going to leave that room that day. It's high quality video, and the notes are shared. And yeah, I mean, it's basically like taking a college course and the 800 meter running or running cross country.
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead.
Well, I don't want to keep you on the phone too much longer. I do want to these are some, I hope you won't find these odd, but these are questions I came up with.
Okay.
If you could follow one professional athlete, this hypothetical is you get to follow one professional athlete. I was thinking American athletes, but I guess it could be anybody in the world. You get to watch every single thing they do, how they eat, how they sleep, every workout, every ice bath between now and Tokyo 2020. Who would you follow?
Oh, wow.
And obviously in this is if you say Evan Jaeger, then it's like the Jerry Schumacher approach to running that event.
Sure. Right? That's interesting. You know who I'd be interested in would it, I mean, it's not just it, in fact, it'd be more not from the training standpoint than from it, but I'd be interested in that is someone like Emma Colburn or Jenny Simpson, because they just seem to always show up. So I'd be curious, like, what's happening there physically and emotionally, but like, what's happening there that, I mean, they, and it's not that they haven't failed, you know, and Jenny had a really big one, you know, but how are they just so tough at the toughest moments? And there's a physical preparation for that, for sure. And then there's the emotional one. So I'd be curious. Those two women would I'd be really curious to see what they do. And then obviously there's other elements like the nutrition and their just daily habits. How they go about that?
Yeah, great. All right, favorite event 800. I was going to say through the marathon, but I guess in this day and age you could. Yeah, you're not going to say an ultra marathon. What is your favorite distance competed in the Olympics, middle to long distance?
That's tough. I'd like to say 4x8 because it should be at the Olympics. You know what? Probably the marathon, just because it's long. I like being able to sit down for 2 hours and watch a running event unfold, you know, like right. I think that's neat. I know there are vast amounts of time where there's not seemingly a whole lot going on. But I was going to say 10K, you know, probably 10K because of the stadium, I guess, just the atmosphere of the stadium. Right. But, and there's a lot more drama in that. It's hard because you don't get to watch it all.
Yeah. All right. So now you are in the Olympic Stadium. What's the non-distance event that you're most fired up to watch?
Non-distance track event?
Yeah. Or I'm sorry, track and field. So any event that's not a distance event.
Oh, 100 meter for sure.
Oh yeah, I love that too. What people don't I would say the 200 is my least favorite. Because if you're just freakishly talented, you can learn how to run a curve and then sprint, right?
Yeah.
But I think the more you understand the 100, and please don't take this, folks, as I'm a student of it, but when you understand that people, there's a certain way to do the acceleration phase, and if it's done incorrectly, you will decelerate sooner in the race.
Yeah.
It just becomes this neat event, you know?
Watching a 100 meter in slow motion, you know, the endless replays is so cool. You know, watching exactly the phases you're talking about is so cool. And I mean, just the if I'm in the stadium watching it live, I can't imagine like something is just more intense than that. And I do like watching them before the race too. I mean, I hate false starts. That's the worst thing in the sport. But I do like seeing like Usain Bolt is like the epitome of flow. Like, you know, what that guy does before a race, like, I would never do that. And if I had an athlete like that, I'd be, like, pissed at him. But he's in a state of flow. That guy is in a perfect state. Like, that is like seeing an artist. He is on the edge of his comfort, but comfortable with it. Like, he knows he's going to be challenged, but he also knows he's going to succeed, and that's where you get flow. It is watching Usain Bolt before the 100. I think is really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do love the phases of the 100 too.
Yeah, cool. All right, so we'll wrap up with just two things. Advice for parents and advice for college coaches.
Advice for parents. We actually talk about this. Parents of high schoolers, I assume.
Yeah,
Is
yeah,
just
yeah.
general advice.
Yeah. Parents from, kids in coming to your program as freshmen through kids who are seniors.
I would say the dinner table conversation, the narrative of your house is going to have more of an impact on, so dinner, let's just call it dinner. Dinner is going to have more of an impact on your son or daughter's performance than I will.
Really?
And
That's fantastic. Wow. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. And you've probably had it as a coach, or you've seen it. I've certainly had it as a coach, where you've got the kid physically ready to go and you cannot get them to perform. And it is not a physical thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we've all experienced that. And, but I think, if I'm going to be honest, my best runners started becoming great, in their house. There's no doubt about it. I'd be totally misreading what is happening if that wasn't the case. And that's why, people always talk about twins, like how lucky you are. We had great twins, and how lucky you are to have two with the same genetic makeup that is, advantageous to running. And I always say, you know what? That's not just the advantage is way greater than that. If there's stuff happening at home that makes one athlete able to perform well, like they're in the right mind frame, they don't take themselves too seriously, they're eating and sleeping right, their family life is safe and secure, they have all their needs met, that's happening for two of my runners at the same time,
Right.
and that's a huge advantage, not just the genetics. So, yeah, I mean, the conversations you have with your kid, I think, are just going to shape their mentality. Are you someone who is describing, writing the story of your life as you determine your success, or are you someone who believes that external factors determine success? Like that simple flip. And, it's how I think failure, for instance, teaching someone about failure while they're failing is the worst time to teach them how to fail. That should be, understanding failure should be front loaded. Like that's a, like, what do you do? Because how much do you fail in running? It's all the time, right? And so how do you interpret that? Well, you learn that. That is a learned skill. And you can interpret that as a really negative experience and a experience that you had little control over and could do little about, or the opposite. Okay, this is an opportunity. I do have control of my fate. I am going to determine that in a better way moving forward. And that's your interpretation of it. And that's the conversation at dinner. I can give all the talks they want to practice. If they go home and the conversation is different, they're all huddled together, and this is what the family narrative is, I can't do anything about that. So, and then what they're eating matters. So, dinner is a big deal.
Absolutely. This is making me feel better. As a single dad, I've done a poor job in the last couple of years of cooking for my kids and sitting down with them. So we've actually done a good job the last month. And this, I'm hearing it from a high school educator who's a high school coach. And thank God they're only 7 and 10, and I can figure this out for a few years. So, well,
Yeah,
another
and
thing
of
is they
course.
actually like to talk to me. Like my 10-year-old, she enjoys talking to me, and from what I hear, that those years are coming to a close probably.
I
So,
hope not. Yeah.
yeah, hope not. All right, and as I said that, I'm like I don't want to end such a great conversation on a bad note. I mean this. I just think it would be really interesting. How many athletes roughly have you had compete collegiately, whether Division III, Division I, Division II?
Oh, I'd have to count. Dozens, I'm not sure.
Okay.
You
Yeah,
know, they're all over the divisions.
so for a college coach out there who might be listening to this, do you have any advice to, help that kid transition from high school to college, or maybe something you'd like to see happen in the recruiting process or something like that?
Oh my God, yes. First of all, you know, you don't recruit times, recruit character, right? So, I mean, what I mean by that is that you've got to have conversations with the family and you got to have conversations with the coach. And, you know, to give you an analogy, really the parenting, since you just brought it up, if I'm going home after school and all right, I'm going to take over with the kids and I'm going to give my wife a break. When I walk in the door, the first thing I ask her is, okay, what's happening? What's going on? And I need that information from her to know where our kids are at so that I can parent them, you know, a little bit more effectively and deal with wherever they're at. And so the analogy is true for a college coach getting a high school coach in their hands too. Those kids at home, we share the same genes. I know them better than anybody else on earth. And still my first question would be, what can you tell me? What do I need to know? And that's still my first question. And so if I'm a college coach, that I'm having that conversation with parents and coaches, you know, what do I need to know about this kid? What can I do with this kid? What would I need not do? And of course you're sifting through that. You're evaluating that. You're not going to take everything that they say, but you are going to end up saving yourself a ton of time figuring that out on your own. You know, I mean, I can't understand how, you know, and you front load with an hour conversation, say, and it's going to save you years of figuring that out, you know?
Absolutely.
So value that understanding. And, you know, every high school coach is different and has different relationship with their athletes. So I get it, but I would seek that out 100%. And then my other biggest suggestion is culture, your team culture, you know, and I know it's a different world. I know it's more business-like than high school is, and the community is a little bit different, you know, and the attention on the sport is different, all those things. But, I mean, look at Alcarius, you know, down the street from me. They just qualified for NCAAs for the 46th year in a row.
And, that's crazy.
I mean, that's stupid. They've been out of the top three times. It's stupid, you know. It's five times. Five times. So he's been 46 times. It's either 45 or 46. I'm getting I can't remember because they either just went from 45 to 46 or just got 45.
Okay.
But either way, five times in his career in the last 45 years, they weren't taking home an NCAA trophy. They weren't on the podium. So, and you go see what's going on there. I know it's a D3 program, but it's just culture, culture, culture. Like everything there is about the culture. And that's that's the most successful NCAA program there is, you know, if you just run the numbers. And I think there's an assumption that they're more, especially if you're feeding them scholarship dollars and that kind of thing, like they're going to motivate themselves and all that. I mean, I just read a quote, where Kobe Bryant was being coached by Mike Krzyzewski for the U.S. Olympic team, and Coach K, of course, goes in there and he's motivating these guys and he's talking about who they are as people and all this stuff. And Kobe Bryant's like, it was the first time I've ever been motivated in my life by someone else. Like, you know, everyone just paid me money.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, I just so valued it. This is a guy that, you know, I mean, he's a self-motivated athlete. He's an adult. He is at the peak of his sport, and he still craves that. You know, what human doesn't crave that, want to be a part of, like, that connection? I mean, that is just basic human psychology. You need to feel like you're connected. So, you know, just in conversations with my athletes and stuff, some coaches do an amazing job at that, and some think, like, it's not important. I'm going to talk to them like adults. They're going to get their work done. And that's it. And, you know, I would argue an adult wants to be talked this way too. It's, you know, it's not a condescending thing. We want to feel purpose. So, I don't know. Those would be my two suggestions. Get connected with the family and the coach and build culture.
That's fantastic. That's great advice. And I know we'll have some college coaches tuning into this. So, well, John, thanks so much for your time. Is there anything that that we didn't talk about that you think is important this time of year? It'll be people who, our high school coaches on high school running coach that'll get this first, and then we'll share it more publicly a little bit later. But is there anything else you'd like to close with?
Yeah, I just kind of emphasize, and I talked about it in Boulder and stuff, is that don't just start by sending them out for runs and that's it. You know, I mentioned the day that we have at least once a week, if not every day, for our new kids. And I'm talking about some kids who are just coming out. They'll come out in 2 weeks for track and have literally no athletic background, right? And so I think you're making a mistake if your first goal is just to ramp up volume and try to get the kid, working volume and say, all right, let's just keep plugging 30 minutes and then 40 minutes and 50 minutes. I think you really got to work on the athletic development of that kid. And so we have days where those kind of kids, first of all, their ability just to run 6 days a week is not there yet. So I wouldn't ask them to run 6 days a week. So we have what I call athletic development days where we would do, say, short hill sprints. We would do jump rope. We'd do, medicine balls, ladders, hurdles, that kind of stuff. Just and be really attentive to it. I think that's going to minimize, that's going to set them up for success. And that's something we're going to, be definitely emphasizing early on.
Great. All right. Well. Thanks so much. I'm not going to put you on the spot here and ask you if you're coming out to Boulder again this year, but hopefully that'll work in your life, because I would love to see you face to face.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I'll be promoting the videos you did last year. It's cool to hear your voice. On a phone call now, because I've listened to your talks like three or four times. You said something at the clinic where you had listened to some of my podcasts, and then there we are face to face, and now I'm having the same experience. So
exactly, yeah,
it's fun. All right, John. Thanks so much for your time and your candor and sharing with us. And I'll look forward to seeing you in 2019.
Sure, sounds great. Thanks, Jay.
Okay.